We Made This. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney, and thank you very much for joining me again for this week's episode, which is a nice special one. I mean, I'll explain what we're doing here in just a moment, but let me first of all bring in today's guest, and it's a pleasure to welcome back Gabriella Masson to the podcast. Hey, Gabriella.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good, thanks. Really good. It's good to reunite. It's been a while, isn't it? I believe Johnny Guitar with Clara was probably the last time we spoke, which is going back a while at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, geez. I mean, that was quite a few months ago. I'm trying to actually remember when we did that. But that was a really nice episode. Sure, it's really nice to be back.
Yeah, I think that if... because another podcast we did was Goldfinger. I think if the new James Bond film hadn't been put back, I think we might have hopefully reunited already. But yeah. Life had other plans. That's how it goes.
Indeed.
Okay, let me explain what we're doing here. So this is the first episode in an 8-part mini-series of sorts that I'm calling The Summer of Psycho. So Alfred Hitchcock's film Psycho marks its 60th anniversary this year. And what I thought would be nice, or what I thought would be interesting anyway, for me at least, if nobody else, but the idea is to do 8 episodes themed around the film. Today's episode with Gabriella and myself is going to be all about Norman Bates. And I'm also planning to do podcasts about Janet Leigh's character, Marion, about some of the other characters in the film, about the shower scene, about the film's music, about some of the behind-the-scenes details, as well as episodes on the Gus Van Sant remake from the 1990s and the 2012 Hitchcock film with Anthony Hopkins. I'm not sure, we'll see how chatty myself and Gabriella are today, but I think that because I'm doing all these episodes, I'm planning to release 2 a week. They may well be shorter than normal. We normally go for about an hour, but some of these episodes might be more like 30, 40 minutes. I don't want to overstay my welcome, basically. And the other thing I need to watch out for, Gabriella, is I'm determined not to repeat myself. And I think that's going to be a challenge for me. So we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
But no, delighted to have you here for the first episode, because I know you're a big Hitchcock fan, aren't you?
Well, I am, like, I think I'm a bit obsessed with him. Like, I know he's a controversial figure, and I know, like, he could be, like, kind of... not the nicest guy or the nicest director, but his influence is so massive. I mean, especially in terms of, like, Psycho is like a proto slasher. And I sometimes think to myself, if Psycho hadn't been made, would we actually have, would horror have been the same? Like, I know that maybe that sounds like very, like almost like hyperbolic, but I mean, it's such a huge influence, that movie. Its legacy is so, like, far-reaching. So, yeah, I mean, I love him. I will literally watch anything that he has directed, and I just about have watched anything he's directed. I just need to really, like, watch more of his silence, but I love The Lodger, for example, which is one of his silent films. Yeah, so I'll just watch anything that he's directed, and I think that his films are fascinating with their psychological themes, and you can see his personal... sort of influences in his directing as well, which I find to be really interesting. So I actually listened to, I don't know if you've listened to the Secret History of Hollywood podcast at all, Carl.
A little bit.
Yeah. And Adam Roche, who's the presenter on that, he did like a whole series, like I think it was like 12 hours long or something on Hitchcock. And it just made me understand him even more, like, you know, why he did certain things and why he presents authority figures the way he does and stuff like that. So, yeah, he's an incredibly fascinating, he's an auteur. I mean, I know we use the word auteur a lot for people, but he really kind of is, like, you know, a guy who really changes the industry and is very artistic. And that's not overstating things, because, like, there are so many directors who were influenced by him. I mean, like, De Palma and Spielberg and, like, a bunch of guys. So, yeah, no, I just love him. And that was a very circumventous reply, but, yes, I love Hitchcock.
Yeah, there's lots to dig into with this. And the thing about what you're saying about Hitchcock as an auteur is that, yeah, and he's also one with mass appeal, which is really interesting. You know, like, this is a film that's widely regarded as one of his best by most reviewers and commentators. as well as being one of his most popular with the ticket buying public as well, which is fascinating to me.
Mm.
Let's start though, before we come on to Norman, let me start with a big spoiler warning. Like, you know, people shouldn't be listening to these podcasts unless they've seen Psycho, hopefully.
Yeah.
On the off chance, Gabriella, that there is somebody listening who hasn't seen it, doesn't know about this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tricky one. Like, how much do you think a first-time viewer should know going into this film about the storyline and about everything? Because, you know, there's some interesting twists and turns. But what would you like people to know if they haven't seen it?
I think the most important thing that they should know about Psycho is that it is, at its core, a story about how isolation can really erode the mental state. So if you are alone for too long, yeah. And as you say, well, like in the middle of a pandemic, we're all like not allowed to leave our houses a lot and stuff. I think Norman Bates wouldn't have struggled during Corona. I'm just saying that. I think, like, you know, being a first-time viewer for Psycho, you should know as little as possible about the movie. The first time I watched Psycho, basically all I knew was it starred Janet Leigh. I didn't even really know Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Perkins was at the time, because I was about 12 the first time I watched this movie, which is probably a bit young, but like I really wanted to watch it. So I knew very little about it. I had heard about the shower scene, but my mom hadn't really wanted me to know much about it before I was 12, because I mean, like, you're a bit young even at 12 to watch Psycho, as I said. But I didn't really even know much about that. And then when I got to, as you say, the interesting twists and turns, it made it even better that I didn't know what to, like, was going to happen, because at the age of 12, you are even more easily scared or upset or whatever than as an adult. But I think, yeah, definitely go into it as cold turkey as possible. Don't even actually watch the trailer. Do what Hitchcock said, in that no one is admitted after the beginning of the movie. Just stick to what he basically did in his marketing, and that's it. I mean, in his original trailer, I think he's like next to the toilet or something, and he's talking about stuff that she's flushed down the toilet. That doesn't give you any idea of what the movie's actually going to be about, which is great. So yeah, literally just know as little as possible, and then I think you'll be good to go. So if you haven't watched Psycho, please don't listen to this episode, as Carl said. You will ruin it for yourself.
Yeah, go and watch the film and then come back, I think, is the advice. But I'm really envious, Gabriella, because when I first saw this film, I knew the twists, I knew the famous scenes, just because there are so many cultural references to it. Like, I'd seen a take on the shower scene in The Simpsons before I ever saw Psycho, and not just various things.
Yes.
I think if there was one film I could travel back in time for to see on the opening day with, like, no knowledge, it would be Psycho, probably.
Oh, yes, it'd be amazing.
Yeah, but I just think it's a great film. I think it's undoubtedly one of his best films.
Mm.
As you kind of said, like, a very significant film. And I think it's just a very stirring film. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that no matter how many times you see Psycho, no matter how familiar you become with it, it just never loses its capacity to kind of provoke and unsettle you.
Yeah.
And it never ceases to, like, linger in the mind. Like, I watched it for the first time this year, a couple of nights ago, and I'm still thinking about it. And even if I wasn't recording a podcast, I think I would be.
Yes, definitely.
And I just think part of that is because it's a pure demonstration of cinema, isn't it? And it shows you how Hitchcock is just a master of cinematic technique, and the things this film does with, like, editing, with camera placement, with music.
Yes.
Are just stunning. And as ever with Hitchcock, those are not careless things, you know.
Mm.
He knows exactly what he's doing. And the interesting thing is, like you were kind of saying as well, I think, like, he's not only got this great command of all these tools at his disposal, but he's also got this very macabre and fascinating, like, sensibility as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, what also fascinates me about the movie is that, you know, Universal didn't want to make the movie. I mean, he brought it to them and he said, I have this bestseller, because it was, you know, that Robert Block had written based on certain murders. You know, the Ed Gein murders. And he said, I really, really want to make this. And Universal was like, no, we can't make this movie. It's a dirty movie, basically. That's what the executives called it. And he shot it with his, I'm sure as you know, Carl, he shot it with his TV crew. And he shot it in black and white because he needed to keep the budget low. And even though he does all these things, it looks like a movie that has such amazing production values. I mean, I watched it on Blu-ray, and sometimes when you watch movies on Blu-ray, like classic films on Blu-ray, it doesn't do them any favors. You know, like, you still love them, but they don't look as great, maybe because certain things look a bit like funny on the Blu-ray or something. But with Psycho, it actually makes the movie even better when you watch it in a better, like, a better print. So yeah, it's just amazing. As you say, the whole macabre sensibility is completely like, you can see it throughout the whole movie, like with the taxidermy and Norman, yeah. Like when Norman smiles at certain points, and like even the whole thing about Norman watching Marion through the hole in the wall. I mean, these are things that probably would have shocked people in 1960. They still make you feel uncomfortable. And as you say, it's definitely on purpose, and it's very cleverly done by mm-hmm. Hitchcock and the whole crew that he had with him. So, and the actors. So yeah, it all works really well.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, we'll let's zero in on Norman, I guess. I just quickly, I'm sure I'll get into Hitchcock a bit more and what he was aiming for in, and some of the behind the scenes stuff in a future episode, but mm-hmm. let's just say at this stage, but it's one of a number of his stories about murderers. And you've already mentioned The Lodger, but things like Rope and Shadow of a Doubt, of course. So kind of fits alongside some of those.
Yes.
Now, in the case of Norman, so Robert Bloch's novel, which I haven't read, but apparently inspired by two sources from real life. So there was a fatal stabbing of a woman over a period of 10 minutes in a respectable city street somewhere, mm-hmm. in which nobody intervened, nobody called the police. That was one inspiration. And as you've already said, Gabriella, you mentioned Ed Gein, mm-hmm. A man who lived in a farmhouse a short distance from a small hamlet in Wisconsin. Yep. And then in 1957, his house was found to be crammed with women's bodies and body parts. So Gein sat in chairs made of human bones. He wore clothes made of skin. Yeah. He had killed at least a dozen women and stole dead bodies from cemeteries. And apparently local gossips and psychologists commented on the unhealthy relationship between Gein and his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the inspiration for Psycho. And in addition to Psycho, Gein was also the inspiration for at least in part, for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the Silence of the Lambs.
Mm-hmm.
So all that's very grisly, of course. What about that book, though, by Robert Bloch? Have you read it?
I haven't. My mom's read it, and a very long time ago, though. She got it out of the library, like, geez, I think it must have been about 20 years ago. And she said she enjoyed it. Robert Bloch, he actually, interestingly enough, did a lot of scripts for Amicus as well. And he had a very macabre sense of humor, like Hitchcock. You know, he had this famous quote where he said, I have the heart of a little boy. I keep it in a jar on my desk. And so I think it's the perfect story, yeah, for Hitchcock to have adapted, because like Hitchcock, Bloch really, he had a humorous way of looking at murder, which is kind of strange, but you see it running throughout the story. Yeah, but the book was, as you say, it was a bestseller because, you know, people like that kind of sensationalism, and also because people knew about Ed Gein and they knew about various murders. So yeah, but my mom, as I said, she's read it, but I haven't. I really should, actually, because I'm sure it's quite good.
Yeah, I feel like I should. I mean, I've been reading some other people's reactions to it. So it's interesting to hear that your mum likes it, because the reviewers I looked at, they were saying, well, the book's not that as, no, definitely not as good as the film. Obviously, provides a lot of the basis for the structure and so on. And the interesting thing in terms of Norman is that apparently in the book, he's described as being fat and 40-ish.
Mm.
So very much unlike Anthony Perkins, of course, isn't it? Because Perkins was 28 when Psycho was released. What about Perkins then? Because I'll confess, I've only seen a few of his other films.
Mm-hmm.
I really need to see more. But what about you? Are you more of a fan of his than I am?
Yeah, I really like him. I think he is a very underrated actor. And I think that he actually should have got more breaks than he did. I think he has an amazing screen presence. He does so well as Norman. There's another movie that I watched that has he and Audrey Hepburn in it called Green Mansions, and they are so good together. I mean, he was such a passionate actor, and you can really see that he was a sensitive, passionate guy in real life, because you can see in that his on-screen presence. And there's another movie that he was in with Kathleen Turner. I can't remember the name now, but it's also very good. He also plays like a psychotic killer, but in that one, he's like a sort of like a street evangelical preacher or something, and it's a role that you could really look stupid in, like he could really have like looked dumb, but he does so well. So I just feel like every movie I see him in, he always impresses me. Like North Sea Hijack with Roger Moore as well. Like he's like the highlight of that movie for me. I mean, I love Roger Moore as well, but Anthony Perkins is the one who like brings it in that movie. And yeah, he just really is a great actor. And I think that this role made him more famous, but I think it was as much a blessing as it was a curse, because after he was in Psycho, everyone was like, "Oh, you're Norman Bates." And he could actually do a lot more than that, because in
Yeah.
Psycho he shows that he has a huge range, and I don't think people really appreciated that about him. And also, plus he's beautiful in this movie. He is like stunning to look at, so that's a nice plus, even though he's playing a psycho. Haha. So
Yeah.
yeah.
Oh, it's definitely, I think it's one of the great performances ever, in Psycho. I was just thinking it's kind of interesting to ponder what qualities from his other films he's kind of bringing to this film in 1960 that an audience at the time might have been familiar with. And like I say, I haven't seen a lot of those films, but I've got a book on Psycho by a guy called Raymond Dergnat. And he said that Perkins at this point in his career often played sensitive or redeemable neurotic young men. He often played characters with like daunting parents. Like one of the films he met, usually fathers though, obviously it's different here, but he mentions in that book a film called The Tin Star, where he plays alongside Henry Fonda as an example of that. So it's just interesting, isn't it, to kind of think about like how much the average moviegoer in 1960 would have been aware of that, but also like how that would have shaped their perceptions of Norman on the first viewing. Because like we kind of say, if you don't know the twists and turns, what you think about Norman to begin with might well be different to what you think second time around, mightn't it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the first time I watched Psycho, I thought, he's a bit creepy, maybe, but but you don't really think that in the beginning. You sort of more start to think that when he's talking to Janet Leigh in his parlor with surrounded by taxidermy animals, you know? Yeah, you're like, this guy's kind of weird. But I mean, when I watched it this week, and it's like, geez, I think it's about the 20th time I've watched this movie, and that's not even an exaggeration. My mom and I turned to each other and went, gosh, you know, Marion should know that this guy's a creepazoid, but it's because we have the hindsight of watching the movie like 19 times before. I mean, if you look at Marion, how is she supposed to know that Norman's a nut job when he is so sweet? He's very polite. Okay, she hears his mother screaming at him, but like, is that going to make you think that this guy's like a homicidal maniac? Not really. So yeah, I think a lot of people would go, oh, you know, I knew what Norman was like from the beginning of the movie. I think you're telling a fib, because you don't know what he's like from the beginning of the movie. Unless, as you say, Carl, you have the cultural, pop culture knowledge behind you. But even then, when you watch the movie, you're like, is this guy really a killer? Interesting. So yeah.
I suppose even in 1960, though, you'd have been on the lookout for some kind of psycho, wouldn't you? Because the film is called Psycho. So it's kind of
Yes,
interesting in that respect.
definitely.
Let's drill into some of these individual scenes and stuff then, which I think would be a good thing to do. So, I mean, just a more general point, first of all, actually. So one of a number of Hitchcock films in which you've got a murderer who rivals other characters as like a focal point. So I think of a film like Uncle Charlie, a character like Uncle Charlie in Shadow of a Doubt, or like Bruno in Strangers on a Train. But Psycho, of course, is a much more dramatic example of that, because the murderer obviously replaces our protagonist partway through the film. I don't know if you've ever read the Hitchcock Truffaut book, Gabriella, the interview book. Have you read that?
No, I haven't read it, but I actually was watching an interview on YouTube the other day that Hitchcock did, which was quite interesting. But I haven't, yeah, I would love to, but you can't get it here very easily where I live, so yeah.
Okay, well, it's not a proper substitute, but I can quote it for you and see what you make of this. So what Truffaut says to Hitchcock is that in that whole picture, in Psycho, there isn't a single character with whom a viewer might identify. And Hitchcock replies by saying, well, it wasn't necessary. Even so, the audience was probably sorry for the poor girl at the time of her death. When Anthony Perkins tells the girl of his life in the motel and the exchange views, you still play upon the girl's problem. It seems as if she's decided to go back to Phoenix and give the money back, and it's possible that the public anticipates this by thinking, ah, this young man is influencing her to change her mind. So that whole exchange in the parlour is a very interesting one, isn't it? Because I think that's a good point, what Hitchcock's saying. Like, the first time round, you probably are thinking more of Marion at that point, because we've been kind of locked into her perspective, haven't we? And I guess it's probably the second viewing where we think of some of the clues we get about Norman in that scene. But it's a marvelous kind of conversation, though, isn't it?
Yes, it's really well played by both Perkins and Lee. I mean, it's really natural. I think they could have very easily sort of gone in for the creepy sort of thing, but they're really just two people having a conversation, and but there are hints in the conversation that Norman's not normal. And I think it's something, yes, as you say, that you pick up on successive viewings, obviously the first time you watch the movie, you're going to pick up on him going, oh, but a boy's best friend is his mother. And you're like, is she? Okay. I didn't really think of that. And then, but then when you watch the movie again, you sort of pick up on him saying, oh, I bet you've never had an unhappy day in your life. And you're like, how do you know, Norman? And he's looking at Marion from a point of view where he probably feels that she hasn't had any hardships or any struggles or any disappointments, and is sort of almost angry with her about that, if you know what I'm trying to say. And you can see it in Perkins' performance, where he kind of his whole physical demeanor changes throughout the scene. He becomes more and more almost aggressive until he gets to the point where he says, have you ever seen inside of a madhouse? You know what they do to people there. And Marion's like, I'm sorry, I misspoke. You don't have to react like that. So it's a scene that really builds, and it builds through the direction, it builds through the camera angles, and it builds through the two actors and the two characters, the way they're behaving. So it's a really riveting scene, and it's one that I always actually look forward to, weirdly enough, because it's so well done. Yeah, so it's very, very interesting.
And what they say is interesting, but also the way that scene is set up and shot. You know, like you mentioned the birds, the stuffed birds, and Hitchcock says in that interview, I was quite intrigued with the birds. They were like symbols. Obviously Perkins is interested in taxidermy since he'd filled his own mother with sawdust, but the owl, for instance, has another connotation. Owls belong to the night world. They are watchers, and this appeals to Perkins' masochism. He knows the birds, and he knows that they're watching him all the time. He can see his own guilt reflected in their knowing eyes. So I kind of like the various things he suggests there, because we do find out, don't we, that Norman is a watcher. We see him watch Marion through the peephole. And yet the way that scene is framed with the birds, they're kind of like looming over him, aren't they? So it's almost like he's a potential victim too, like they're posed to kind of swoop on him. So I just kind of I see it as being like symbolic of the kind of split in his kind of mentality. I don't know how you see it.
No, definitely. I mean, he makes the birds later on, based on Daphne du Maurier's short story. So I think Hitchcock definitely had a fascination with what birds do in nature and all that kind of stuff. I mean, and the thing is that owls and I think it's a crow that he's also stuffed there. Those are predatory birds. They are birds of prey, and Norman is a predator if you think about it as well. So as you say, even though they're watching him, and you feel that maybe he might be a victim of them, they can't really do anything to him because they're stuffed, they're dead. And Norman is actually, funny enough, the most dangerous predator in the room, even though the birds were predators when they were alive, because he's actually killed predatory birds himself. He's managed to kill something in nature that actually feeds off of other things, and he's doing that, if you think about it, from the motel. He's feeding off of young women who come into his path, and he's feeding his neuroses and his psychosis and all of that kind of stuff through the murder of them. So yeah, that's actually really clever. That's Hitchcock for you though. All these layers, that you come across in his work.
Because I think the other thing that those birds do is it kind of prepares the way. It's that interesting blend of normality and deviance, because I'm sure there may well be taxidermists listening. I'm sure it's an honorable hobby, but I think a lot of people would feel like there's something a bit grisly about it as well. So it kind of helps pave the way for that murder in a way, this kind of tonal shift, which I think starts when we first see the Bates house. I was thinking about that sort of conversation in terms of this kind of parallel between Marion and Norman, in the sense that it seems like to her, Norman's predicament that he describes, almost as if she's thinking that that's kind of what the kind of thing that would happen to her if she continues along her present course of action. It seems like he is trapped. And again, I think the birds play into this because they're kind of hemming him in visually. And that maybe her impulsive behavior is going to lead to a situation where she's similarly trapped, whether she's imprisoned, if she gets caught,
Exactly.
But again, I think it plays very differently on a second time. And I think watching the film recently, you're just much more cognizant of the way that Norman's being set up through their exchanges. Like, I'll tell you a bit of dialogue I really liked is when Norman, I think it's outside the cabin actually, but it's when he says his mother isn't quite herself today. Mm. And it's just a line you never think about the first time.
No.
It's just a very mundane phrase. You never think about it. And it has a very interesting double meaning, of course.
Yeah.
In general terms then, like, to what extent do you think Norman is set up as being a sympathetic character before the murder? Like, do you feel like we identify with him before that point if we haven't seen the film before?
I think to a certain extent you do. I think, as you were saying earlier, Carl, you definitely sympathise with Marion way more. Like, I do, every viewing, I always sympathise with Marion. I'm a woman, and I get her sort of hopes and dreams and stuff, and that she's not a bad person. But I think Norman as well. Norman, even though, it's so weird to say this, even though he is a murderer, he has this split personality where one side of him is a good guy. He's a guy who is trying to keep his head above water. He's trying to keep this business going. I mean, he's like in the middle of nowhere. I mean, he's like 15 miles out of town, as he says to her, and he changes these cabins, these rooms, 12 of them, every single week, even though there's no one there. He's alone all the time, this poor guy. I always see him as being rather a pathetic character before you find out that he's actually super dangerous. And you do sympathize with him. You think he's sweet, you think he's nice. And as I said, the fact that Anthony Perkins is so handsome.
Yeah.
He's almost like...
unlikable.
He's very likable. He smiles a lot. He has this lovely smile. My mom even commented on it. She was like, oh, you know, when Anthony Perkins smiles, he looks so lovely. And he does. He looks so approachable. And he seems so sweet to Marion. I mean, she, in the previous scenes, has been treated like a thing by that Texas millionaire. But Norman is like... so nice to her. He's like, oh, you know, are you all right? Oh, you're wet. Oh, come and have supper with me. Oh, you know, it's so nice to have company. I'm so happy you're here. You know, he just seems very approachable and nice. But I think from a female perspective, I also kind of think to myself, this has to be 1960, because I would firstly never stop at a motel that's just run by a guy. I'd be like, no way. I'd carry on driving, because you don't know what that guy's going to do to you, you know? Like, in 2020, if you stopped in a motel that was owned by a young man, you'd think, this guy could rape me, this guy could murder me. And, you know, that's the thing. But in 1960, people weren't thinking like that. People still let their kids walk around, and you know, it was a totally different society. So, yeah, watching it now as with Norman, I think he looks like a lovely young man, but there's a lot of young men now who have been accused of rape and stuff like that, who look like lovely young men, but they aren't. They like sort of the wolf in sheep's clothing, and that's what Norman is, you know?
Yeah, and then so I agree, I think, like, because he seems very sensitive, quite kind to Marion, seems vulnerable. Yeah, I think our sympathy is with him to a large extent. But then I think it's complicated perhaps when we see him spying on Marion, but that's a very interesting scene too, isn't it?
Because
obviously we get point of view shots, so we see it from his point of view. So in a way, I feel like we're kind of implicated as viewers there, because like it's voyeurism, but I don't think we turn away from the shot of Marion changing, you know. No. I think most of us probably don't. No. So we're spying on her too. So I feel like there's this voyeuristic aspect, but I don't think that entirely like wipes away the protectiveness we might feel for Norman based on what we've seen. Yeah. But those shots are just fascinating, aren't we? Because like I say, we're seeing Norman's perspective, but it's also Hitchcock's perspective, and it's also our own, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like a triple sort of layer. Yeah, no, I mean, I still feel shocked when I see Norman spying on Marion. I'm like, Norman, do not do that. It's weird. Don't look at her, have a shower, you know. But at the same time, you're thinking, obviously, he finds her to be desirable because Marion's beautiful. She's a very beautiful woman. But like, just because you find a woman beautiful, don't stare at her through a peephole when she gets showered. It's weird. It's like there are boundaries. And you can see, because Norman's lived alone for so long and he had a very weird mother, that he doesn't understand those boundaries at all. And the sexual boundaries in his mind are so blurred and so distorted that he does that. And as you say, we don't turn away from it because we at the same time are sort of like oddly fascinated by what's going on. It's a bit like people who rubberneck at a car, like a car accident. You know, it's the same sort of feeling. You're like, I shouldn't be looking, but I'm going to look, what's going to happen, you know, that kind of thing. It builds the suspense. Yeah,
yeah. It does. And then, of course, so then we get the murder scene. Now, I'll keep my comments relatively brief on this because, like I say, I'm going to do an episode just on that shower scene alone. But I thought it was interesting that Perkins doesn't play Mrs. Bates in that scene.
Oh, okay.
He doesn't provide the vocals for the mother that we hear elsewhere either. So Mrs. Bates is played by more than one double during the film.
Okay.
And then you've got several people providing her voice, including a man, but not Perkins. So that's kind of interesting to me because I think that kind of also reflects the psychological thing that's going on, doesn't it, to some extent? Like there's this split.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's what Hitchcock was thinking, but it's fascinating, yeah.
Probably knowing him.
Well, I think so, because I think a lot of the things that like that are intentional from him. Mm. I think he gave a lot of thought to things like that.
Yeah.
So how do you see the murder, though? Like, what do you think is actually motivating his desire to murder Marion? Like, do you see it? I think it's been read in different ways. Like, is it a substitute for sex? Because, like, she's not attracted to him, we don't think.
Mm-hmm.
So he kills her, and the knife is kind of like, it's almost like a phallic symbol or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or is it about her freedom? Like, he's trapped, but she's able to move on with her life, and she's about to.
Yes.
You know, psychologically and as well as actually leaving the motel. So, I don't know. How do you kind of see it? Like, what do you think is motivating it? Or is it a mix of things?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. I think Norman, I don't think Norman's ever had sex. I think he's a virgin still. And I think that he had weird Oedipal incestuous feelings to his mother. I think that's quite clear in the story. Because as a psychiatrist says at the end of the movie, they lived together as if there was no one else in the world. I mean, they live like that together until he's like 17. He's going through puberty as a young man. Then when he kills Marion, he's like, like in his late 20s, he's about the same age as me. And he has to have sexual desires. I mean, like he's not a sexless being, you can see. I mean,
Well, presumably he wouldn't look through the peephole unless... Yeah. There must be a sexual aspect to that, isn't there?
Exactly. I mean, even though he presents himself as like being like a little lost boy, which Marion sort of talks to him as if he is, I think he definitely desires her sexually, and he feels very frustrated by the fact that he can't have sex with her. And he wouldn't even know how to anyway. He wouldn't know where to begin. So it's this very like... It's this very angry, sort of sexually deviant motivated attack that he does on her. I mean, I think it's almost like Hitchcock is kind of exploring a extreme version of when men can't perform sexually with women. You know, like if a guy can't sort of like get a like an erection or something like that during a sexual act. I think it's sort of a very extreme representation of that and very violent. And I think, you know, a lot of men do blame women for the fact that they can't perform sexually, but they don't necessarily murder women, obviously. But I mean, Norman does that because he's like so like messed up in his head. And then I think it's definitely the fact that he kills her and he's killed two young women before her. And these are all young women who are passing through, as you say, who are traveling, who have things to look forward to, who are young and bright and beautiful and have sort of all of these advantages in the world. And Norman has none of that. And people view him as being strange. Like the sheriff talks about him as like being a hermit and being like imbalanced and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's definitely a combination of those things. I think it's a scene that you cannot pin a simple interpretation onto. You can't be like, oh, this is definitely what's happening there, because it's one that you that for me, every time I watch it, I get different ideas about it. So
because one moment I thought was interesting this time around is like when she checks in and he seems to take note that the fact that she says she's from Los Angeles, doesn't she?
Yes.
And like I suppose that has connotations of like glamour and escape that location just brings with it too.
Yes.
Okay, so moving on then. So again, what we get is the cleanup operation, don't we? Of course, first time around, we don't know that Norman is the killer, but we know he comes to clean up the crime scene.
Yes.
Okay, so what Truffaut says in that book is one intriguing aspect is the way the picture makes the viewer constantly switch loyalties. At the beginning, he hopes that Janet Leigh won't be caught. Truffaut assuming a male viewer there, but anyway.
Yeah.
The murder is very shocking, but as soon as Perkins wipes away the traces of the killing, we begin to side with him to hope that he won't be found out. So I don't know, I think that cleanup sequence is really interesting. I imagine, and I'm just imagining, but I imagine seeing that film for the first time in 1960, the fact that that scene's so extended, I think maybe it's like a necessary kind of come down, in the sense that I think the audience is probably so shocked that the star of the film has just been dispatched.
Mm.
They need a bit of time to process that before the pace picks up again.
Yes.
But I think Truffaut's onto something. Like, I don't necessarily think that we instantly forget Marion, though, because we can't, you know, because we're still with her, with her body.
Mm-hmm.
I think if Hitchcock had wanted us to immediately switch our allegiance, we'd have cut away to Lila or somebody.
Yeah.
And, you can imagine that happening.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what happens. I think that Norman's likability, though, which is established earlier, comes into play during that cleanup sequence. I imagine we are sort of identifying with his plight, at least at that point. Mm. What do you think?
I do agree. Yeah. I think, you know, the thing is that definitely the first time you watch it, you're like, oh gosh, I hope that Norman doesn't get blamed for this because his mother did it. But at the same time, even the first time you watch the film, you're like, but this guy's an accessory to murder, you know, and you think to yourself, how many times has he cleaned up after his mother, you know, and the way he turns away in shock and covers his mouth like that sort of makes him more human, because he's having a very human reaction to the murder. He's not having a psychotic reaction to it. But as you say, we definitely don't forget Marion, because Hitchcock zooms in on her eye like that. And then she's got the water there and it almost looks like she's crying, you know? And she's been dispatched while she's so vulnerable. And then Norman mm-hmm. packs her up, he like wraps her up in the shower curtain. And the way he looks at her, he looks at her for like way too long. I mean, you're like, why are you staring at her dead body like that? You know, it's odd. And then the way he sort of then dispatches her and stares at the car as it goes down into mud. Like, why do you have to stand there so long, Norman? Like, you know that the car is going to sink. As a normal human being, I firstly don't think I'd ever clean up a murder scene, because I'd be like vomiting. But I wouldn't watch the car as it went down. I'd be like, okay, the car's gone, like it's going, I'm leaving now, you know. But he almost watches it with this weird sort of satisfactory, like, oh, I'm going to get away with it kind of thing. But then as you say, Carl, maybe I'm looking at this from the point of view where I've seen the movie like lots of times, so I know he's thinking as a murderer maybe already.
Yeah.
So that clouds it a bit.
I think first time around, yeah, like you say, it's not like morally necessarily the best thing to do, but we realize that it's a difficult problem to resolve.
Mm.
You know, we realize he feels protective about his mother and so on.
Yeah.
And I think what Hitchcock is doing is trying to make us feel a bit closer to Norman here, in the sense, like, there's that moment where, because we know all about the money,
mm-hmm.
but he almost overlooks it, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
And like, when he goes to leave, I'm kind of thinking, like, go back, don't get the money. yeah. And there's that moment where he hears a car going by. Mm-hmm. And like, we can understand the threat of being found doing something taboo.
Yes.
I mean, most of us, you know, probably listeners, if you probably haven't committed or covered up a murder, but I'm sure we've all found ourselves at one point or another doing something we wouldn't want to be discovered doing, you know. So, but I think you can argue what Hitchcock's doing is a bit perverse, but I kind of like that. And that moment where the car's sinking, though.
Mm-hmm.
The best moment is when it stops sinking, isn't it?
Yeah, you're like, is it going to sink?
Yeah. And like, I think what Hitchcock says is, in this book, when Perkins is looking at the car sinking in the pond, even though he's burying a body, when the car stops sinking for a moment, the public is thinking, I hope it goes all the way down. It's a natural instinct. And I think he's right. I think there's like a real uh-oh kind of feeling when that car pauses there, doesn't it?
Definitely.
But then he's also like snacking on candy and stuff during that whole thing, isn't he? And like he gives a weird smile at the end. So I think Hitchcock, I think there are things there which, I think there is some sleight of hand in the film elsewhere, but I think Hitchcock generally plays fair, and there are these clues that we can point to afterwards, aren't there?
Mm, definitely. I mean, I wouldn't be eating after dispatching a body. I mean, like, I know it's 1960, so the violence is played down a bit. I mean, if you had to watch, if this movie was made now, I mean, there would be a lot more gore, a lot more, like, you know, seeing everything. And I think that's what makes this movie so great, is that you don't see everything all the time. But, yeah, I think the fact that he's eating and he's smiling at the end, and he kind of, as I said, he looks like he's done this lots of times before. The way he just gets the mops, the way he wraps her up. I mean, if you hadn't done this before, you'd be freaking out and you'd be going, what am I going to do? And he doesn't do any of that. So it's a bit telling, I think.
It's very, very clinical, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
Okay, so then we get these other characters who come into the mix, don't we? So we get, I mean, we've met Sam already, but he comes back into the picture. We meet Lila and mm-hmm. we meet Detective Arbogast.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, isn't it? Because those characters, we know much less about them, don't we, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Like somebody like Arbogast, he turns up much later in the film than Norman.
Yeah.
They're not really developed as characters to the same extent.
Mm-mm.
So in a way, is there a sense that they're kind of like blunt instruments just designed to get us as the audience to the heart of the mystery? So what I was wondering was, like, on my most recent viewing, I was trying to pay attention to, like, not just what I was seeing and what I was thinking, but, like, what I was feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And, like I say, when the car pauses on its way down into the swamp, I think at that point I'm identifying with Norman, I've got to confess.
Okay, yeah.
In those later conversations, like when Norman and Arbogast talk, mm-hmm. when Norman and Sam talk, I felt a bit more equivocal. I'm not sure who I was kind of rooting for. Mm. Well, how about you? That scene with Arbogast, first of all. I was split. I felt like I wanted the detective to make progress, but I also felt deeply uncomfortable for Norman because his lies started to unravel. So what about you?
Okay, I definitely don't like Arbogast in the beginning. You know, when he's talking to Sam and Lila, I'm like, you're a jerk. You know, he makes Marion sound like she's this horrible, like she's committed murder or something. And you're like, okay, I know she stole the money, but like, calm down. when he's talking to Norman, he's very like slick about it. He really wants to trap Norman. He's like, oh, but you said you didn't see her. And then Norman's like, oh, can I look at the photo again? And then he's like, oh, but can I look through your, you know, where you have to sign in? And Norman's like, yeah, of course, you know, because Norman, you can see naturally is used to doing what people are ask of him. So he just naturally sort of capitulates to what Arbogast wants him to do. And Arbogast is not the most likable character, and Martin Balsam's portrayal of him is so clever because he, as you say, he's only in a very small amount of the movie. Like, what is it? Maybe 15 minutes, maybe 20 at a push. And he makes a really big impact. The only time you really think to yourself that he's sort of a more sympathetic character is when he phones Lala and says, you know, Marion was definitely here. But when he's talking to Norman, he's pretty cold. He's pretty unsympathetic, you know, and I think he really wants to catch Norman out. And I think from the beginning, he already knows before he's asked the questions that Norman is not kosher, that he doesn't trust him. But unfortunately, he sort of doesn't go with that. He thinks, oh, what if I speak to the mother? And then you think, oh, well, you know, what is that? Like, I mean, the first time you watch the movie, you're going to go, okay. But the second, third, whatever, fourth time you watch the movie, you're like, oh my gosh, don't talk to the mother. It's not going to work out. But yeah, he's very unsympathetic in the way that he treats Norman. But at the same time, you're thinking Norman has been complicit in a murder, and then later on, you know, he's committed the murder. So Arbogast becomes a bit more sympathetic in knowing that he's actually not the bad guy and actually Norman is. So it's a tricky situation. It's as you say, it's difficult to actually say who you're really rooting for in that situation. It's not cut and dry at all.
The way I was thinking about it was like in Strange on a Train, I don't know if you remember, there's a scene at a tennis match where you see all the crowd's heads going back one way and then the other. I was thinking of that scene as being like a tennis match because like Arbogast, it's like he's constantly mixing up his game to try and outfox Norman, isn't it? Like he drops in things like, oh, did you spend a night with her? And it's kind of like, you know, like how a tennis player might just do a drop shot out of nowhere to try and catch out the other guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a fascinating scene because what I read was like the two actors did a take where they just really got into it and like the crew burst into applause afterwards or something. I really like that scene.
Wow.
What about, so Lila goes into the house. I thought we could discuss like what the house tells us about Norman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's a very interesting, just all the decor, everything we see in that house. We see his bedroom, of course, the upstairs bedroom.
Yes.
I don't know. What do you think? What did you take away? What did that signify to Norman's character, about Norman's character to you?
Well, I mean, firstly, when you see the inside of the house, he clearly hasn't changed it in 10 years. I mean, it's probably exactly the way his mother decorated it. And you think any normal guy would have changed things up a bit, you know? I think any normal sort of guy would have made more of an effort to get away from that sort of setup, you know, because there's what is actually holding him there, you know. Okay, later on you realize his mother's already dead. I suppose you're thinking, oh, his mother's keeping him there if you haven't seen the movie before. But yeah, that house is very clearly his mother's. It's not his house. It doesn't have a lot of his influence at all. It's very sort of almost Victorian because you're thinking his mother probably would have been born in the late Victorian, early 1900s because she's supposed to be, what, in her 70s? She's still alive. And yeah, it's definitely not his domain. It looks like one that his mother has carefully, and then you realize later that he's carefully enshrined to her memory which is like it shows the neuroses and the obsession and the strange psychosexual urges that he has. And then when she goes into his bedroom, it's like a little boy's bedroom. It's weird. I mean, he's got, it looks like he hasn't redecorated that room since he was 10, you know? And okay, he's got albums there, which are like records that an adult would listen to.
Beethoven.
Yeah. A child wouldn't, I don't think most children would want to listen to that. But the rest of the room with the picture of the ship, and there's a teddy bear, and he's sleeping in a bed that looks way too small for him. I mean, he's about 6 foot something, and he's sleeping in a bed that's for like a kid who's like 5 foot something. And you can just imagine him sort of scrunched up on the bed like a child would sleep. So it's this stasis that Norman's living in. He's trying to live in a way that his mother hasn't been dead for the last 10 years and he didn't actually cause her death. So it tells you a lot about his mental state, where he doesn't actually have the capacity to grow up. Even though he's physically in his late 20s, mentally he's much younger than that. So you see that in the house.
Yeah. And like you say, the split though with like the toys, but on the one hand, the record is interesting. And I just, that house just feels like a very oppressive environment to me, doesn't it?
Definitely.
And like that sunken indentation in the bed always kind of creeps me out.
Oh, yeah.
The mother's body's obviously been laid down. And there's also that great moment where Lila, in his room, in Norman's room, she picks up that book and opens it, and we see her reaction, which is kind of enigmatic, but we don't know what she sees. I've always wondered what is she seeing? Like, has he got pornography or what? You know,
I would agree. I think it's probably pornography, because he's at a very unhealthy way of looking at sex. And I wouldn't be surprised. I'm probably reading too much into this, Cole, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was quite extreme pornography, almost like, you know, like a bit violent or something like that, because I think that's something that Norman would enjoy, if I can say that. So yeah, Hitchcock's very clever, because he knows that if he shows too much, he's going to ruin things. But you sort of, as the audience, can read more into things that you're not shown. So that's a clever thing that he does there.
Yeah, and of course, I think you're reading on, it's interesting, but of course, we'll just never know what she saw, which is why it's a really effective moment, I think. Because I think all that stuff in the house, it just deepens the mystery around him in some ways.
You definitely.
Know, and the complexity around him. So yeah, I suppose towards the end of the film then, so he gets caught, of course, happily, I suppose.
Yeah.
And what about all that stuff, though, at the very end of the film, like the last glimpse we get of Norman here? So it's pretty eerie stuff, isn't it? Like, his identity is fully just kind of subsumed by his mother's now, isn't it?
Mm.
What did you make of that whole scene?
I think it's very cleverly done. I actually really, really enjoy that scene. Like, I weirdly, macabrely enjoy the fact that he is dressed in his mother's clothing earlier on as well. I think that's well done. The way that Anthony Perkins changes his facial expression almost into this weird, like, gleeful thing, the way he's looking at Vera Miles' character, is very clever. And then, at the end, you know, where you have the voiceover of the mother. What I think they probably must have done is someone was probably standing there saying the lines to Anthony Perkins so that he could react accordingly. But he does it so well. Like, the way his face changes infinitesimally. I mean, it's a good 5 minutes that you see. And the way he sort of looks down at the fly, and the mother's voice is, I'm not even going to swat this fly, and as if I could do anything. And, I had to give up Norman because I didn't do anything. I didn't kill those girls. And just the way his face is very, like, thoughtful, but it's, like, creepy at the same time. And also, it's clever the way that when the cop gives him the blanket, you hear the mother's voice saying thank you. You don't hear Norman's voice. Yeah. So as you say, it reinforces the fact that dad is, he's completely gone now. And I love the way he then smiles at the end, and the mother's voice says, I'm not going to move at all. Like, I'm not going to do anything. And then the skull appears over his face, which is so cleverly done. I think if another director, like a less competent director, had done that, it would have looked dumb. But the way that Hitchcock makes it flash very briefly before you see the car being lifted up out of the marsh, it's really a testament to the fact that Anthony Perkins probably should have been nominated for an Oscar for this film. Because that is a masterclass in acting at the end there. It is so subtle. It is so powerful. He's not saying a word, and yet you know the way he's reacting is perfectly matching with the mother's voice. It's like, I love the way that movie ends. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's just it's unforgettable. And like, just the idea that, okay, the authorities have caught up with him. He's contained, but he's still this kind of monstrous figure, isn't it? It's vividly kind of signaled to us in that scene, which is very, very creepy. And that shot of the skull is great. I love the way it's done as kind of a composite. So
yes,
apparently it wasn't scripted, and apparently it's not included on all prints of the film. So it makes me wonder if it's a kind of last minute addition. But
okay,
I think it's possible to imagine a first time viewer, because it's done as a composite, maybe someone not quite sure if they've seen what they think they've just seen. You know?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't push it all the way. He doesn't have the skull fully replace Norman's head. It's blended, which I think I like that idea of all. It's not subliminal, but almost.
Yes. Very true.
Okay, so other thing I thought we could talk about is, and you kind of mentioned it at the outset, really, but Anthony Perkins' relationship with this role, which has some good aspects and some bad ones, I think.
Yeah.
Now, one thing I'm not doing on these podcast episodes is, it would have been interesting to look at the Psycho sequels, but not this time. But you've seen a few of those sequels, haven't you, Gabriel? I haven't seen them, but I know Psycho 2 in particular has some fans. But which ones have you seen, and what have you made of them?
I've seen the second and the third one. Now, the problem with me, I've got a friend who loves the sequels, and she's probably going to be rather upset with me because I always get confused between the second and the third movies. I think it's the second one where he comes back to the base motel after he's been released from this insane asylum, and there's a young nun there, if I remember correctly. And he sort of then, it's about their relationship and how they react together, and like she almost becomes like a representation, like a connected thing with him, because they both have mental health issues and stuff like that. But I don't really remember the third one very well. As I said, I could be talking about the third one when it's actually like, you know, the second one I think I'm talking about or something. But I remember, though, that the second and the third movies are good because Anthony Perkins is in them. They don't, from what my memory of them, because I haven't seen them in years, is that they're not as like artistically sort of accomplished, obviously, as Hitchcock's original is. But Anthony Perkins is still incredible as Norman. And he's changed physically, obviously. He's a lot older in the later films, which is cool because he's kind of lost that very pretty, soft, boyish look that he had when he was younger. Because the way that Anthony Perkins aged was that he became thinner and sort of like harder facially. He was still handsome, but he looks almost like more worn down, which I think matches the character in the sequels.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, of course, that's why Hitchcock chose him for the original film, you know, because he was a pretty young man, handsome, and the boy next door, and he was clean cut, you know. And there are pictures of Hitchcock and Anthony Perkins standing together on the set. And you can see that Anthony Perkins is sort of, you can see he's confident. He's used to being on set. He's made quite a few movies, but he's almost intimidated a little bit by Hitchcock. And Hitchcock looks very different in photos that he's standing with Perkins to when he's standing with Janet Leigh. There's like a different, the way their stances are and stuff like that. So it's also interesting to look at those, how it must have been on set between them. Because I think that Perkins realized, because he was an intelligent young man, realized that he was working with, I mean, obviously Hitchcock already had a fantastic reputation by that point, but I think Perkins realized that he was playing a role that was important. But I don't think he probably realized how it was going to consume his career to such a degree. I mean, there are few actors who are connected with a role the way Anthony Perkins is connected with Norman Bates. Some people don't even, a lot of people don't even know Anthony Perkins' name. They'll just say, oh, Norman Bates, you know?
Yeah.
And that must be tough as an actor, to have people just think that you're one character when you actually are like capable of playing other ones as well.
Yeah, and like he'd been nominated for an Oscar before this role, and like you say, he could do all sorts of things, and it came to be what he was known for.
Yeah.
Because I was looking at some articles about him, and I was reading an obituary somewhere. I know he'd done a quote. So this was a quote from his wife, Berry Berenson, in an interview shortly after his death. And she said, at one point he went 2 years without working, but he was such a stoic. He never talked about it. He never complained. He learned to play the piano. He made phone calls. He would sit by the phone and wait for the agents to call. He had such mixed feelings about Norman Bates. On the one hand, he began thinking that others in the industry saw him as that character, strange and weird. And on the other hand, it was a burden. It was very limiting to his career. So that's kind of sad to hear about, isn't it? I think it kind of speaks to what you were just saying there, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think also I've had a lot of people on Twitter say to me, oh, but didn't Anthony Perkins have a weird relationship with his mother? I'm like, where are you getting this from? He's not Norman Bates, you know, he's not Norman Bates in real life. You know, I don't know what relationship he had with his mother, but let's not assume he had a weird relationship with his own mother because he's playing Norman Bates in a movie. And I think that's kind of damaging to people's legacies, you know, where people start conflating a character so much with them that they think that they're the character. Mm. I mean, I think it's really unfair to think that Anthony Perkins was this perverse weirdo because he played Norman Bates, you know? And I know a lot of people, I've had a lot of people say, oh, but he was gay, you know, to me on Twitter. And I'm like, so? What difference does that make that he was gay? I mean, he was a fantastic actor. He could have been attracted to pink elephants, whatever. He was a great actor, you know, he does so well in this movie. And I think that people want the actor to be like the character. They want sensationalism. And they get very disappointed when they realize that an actor is just a normal person who's doing a job and it enjoys their job and they don't have a mother in the fruit cellar or something like that, you know? So, yeah, it is sad to hear. I think, you know, he and his wife had a very special relationship because she was there for him throughout their marriage. And, you know, I think that they cared about each other a lot. And I think it's very sad, as you say, Carl, to hear that he had to wait to be offered roles after he was clearly such a good actor. Sorry, I'm getting very passionate about this, but yeah.
No, that's okay. No, I agree. I totally agree. I did come across an interesting anecdote about him, though, which is in the book, A Long Hard Look at Psycho, the Raymond Dergnat book. But apparently Perkins disrupted a National Film Theatre showing of Psycho because he was laughing all the way through it. It was kind of interesting to me. But I don't know if you heard that, but this idea that when Psycho was released, like a lot of younger, like teen audiences or whoever, kind of took it as a very, you know, uproarious comedy, which is kind of interesting to think about. Yeah.
Okay, that's fascinating. Typical, I must say, when I was a teenager, I had a really inappropriate sense of humor. I kind of do still, but it's not as bad as it used to be. So yeah, I can imagine that.
All right, Gabriella, before we finish though, I mean, I'm not going to talk about Vince Vaughn as Norman Bates here, because like I said, I'm going to do a whole episode on the Gus Van Sant Psycho at some point.
Yeah,
I was wondering if you'd seen Freddie Highmore's portrayal of Norman Bates on the show Bates Motel, which I've seen some of, but not all. Have you seen that? And what do you make of it, if you have?
I watched the whole series, actually, from start to finish. I really enjoyed it. I think Freddie Highmore is really good. And I think he's clever. It's definitely apparent that he watched this movie many, many times. And you know, he really replicates the sort of physicality that Anthony Perkins has in the original film, which is interesting. And he actually physically looks like Anthony Perkins in some ways. You know, he's also very tall and slim and like boyish and stuff like that. I think, you know, the thing is that with Freddie Highmore, he plays Norman Bates over a number of seasons of a show.
Yeah.
So he has to, he kind of, you can see him sort of adapting the role. And towards the end of the Bates Motel, he becomes Norman in the movie. He's not Norman in the movie from the beginning. So that's interesting, where you can sort of see him being more innocent. And he's also playing Norman when his mother's still alive. So that also changes the role a bit as well. I don't think that Freddie Highmore obviously is as iconic as Anthony Perkins, and I don't think that Freddie Highmore would claim to have the same impact, obviously, as Anthony Perkins, but I think he does really well in the role. I think it must be very daunting to take over a role like that. I wouldn't want to.
Yeah.
I'd be very scared that people would make fun of me and stuff like that, you know. So, yeah, he does really well, and I enjoyed it. I think he has more, as I said, more time to develop certain things about the character, but it's quite different. It's a different format and stuff, but I enjoyed that show a lot. It's a nice companion thing to watch with the original movie.
I thought it was just an interesting series, how it kind of fleshes out, like in the film it's just kind of a line, isn't it? Oh, they moved away the highway. And then in the first season of the show there's actually quite a bit of stuff going on about that.
Yes,
yeah, it's interesting. Clever. All right, Gabriella. Well, at the outset, I said we'll be sticking to like 30, 40-minute episodes, and it hasn't quite worked out like that.
Sorry.
But hey, that's the way it goes. No, it's good. It's good. It's been fun. Yeah, so before I sort of tee up the next episode, like, Gabriella, tell us about your, because it's been a while since we spoke, and I know you've been doing your own podcasting and stuff. And I think some new podcasts since we last spoke on this pod on the Movie Palace. So yeah, what have you launched? What are you up to? What's going on?
Well, my original podcast that I started with, and the one that I still probably obviously have the biggest following for because it's been going on the longest, is the You Won't Forget Me All About Joan Crawford podcast. And that's all about Joan Crawford and her career. I focus on her career and her film legacy. What I wanted to do with that podcast was get away from her personal life, because what's happened with Joan Crawford is that people remember her for being Joan Crawford and her personal life and Mommy Dearest and all that kind of stuff. And they forget that she was actually a bloody good actress, you know? And I want to, I don't know if I could say remind people of that, but I want people to remember the fact that she's, you know, really good. And she had a really big impact on people. So I have done quite a few episodes on that. I think I've done 4 episodes now. But then the other podcast that I'm doing is called By Projection Light. So that's all about classic film and radio. And I talk about films that I've been watching that have been made, that were made between the 1930s and the 1970s. So it's quite a big, broad sort of period, but it's interesting to look at movies that are made in the golden age and then sort of towards when the studios are sort of collapsing and stuff. And then I throw classic radio in there because for me, classic radio is a joy. I love classic radio programs. Then I do Here Lies Amicus. I do that with my friend Kevin. He does the Film Guff podcast as well. And he and I love Amicus movies, and we realized that no one was doing a podcast on Amicus productions. Everyone does one on Hammer, you know, like it's glutted with Hammer. So we thought, oh wow, okay, let's talk about Amicus films. And we've actually, well, at the time of this recording, we've just released our second full-length episode, which is about Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, say that 10 mm-hmm. times fast. And we had a very exciting guest on called Jonathan Southcott. He's a very successful British producer who knew and knows quite a few of the people who were involved in Amicus. So yeah, that's all the stuff that I do. I also blog about classic films and stuff like that. So yeah.
Yeah.
So I just love films.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, just quickly on social media, where can people find you or the podcasts or whatever, or the blog?
Okay. So You Won't Forget Me pod is, Forget Me, You Won't. I'm trying to think of the Twitter handle. Okay. And then Amicus is Amicus Here. And then By Projection Light is By Projection. So that's all obviously with ats in the beginning. And that's, and then my podcast, my blog is Pale Writer on WordPress. So you can go and check that out if you want to, and come and chat to me about various things. I love talking about movies. So yeah, I am on Twitter and the socials and all that stuff.
Perfect. Yeah. Cheers, Gabriella. Like I said, I really enjoyed this, this episode, this recording.
That's cool.
Coming up next on the Summit of Psycho, hopefully later this week, is, it seems appropriate. I mean, we started with Norman. Mm-hmm. So it only seems fair now to look at Marion Crane. So yeah, Marion will be the focus of the next one. In the meantime, you can find the Movie Palace online in the usual places. So Twitter at Movie Palace Pod, also on Facebook and Instagram. But that's it for today, listeners. I hope you can join me next time when the curtain rises once again at the Movie Palace.
Elsewhere on We Made This. We played this.
I had Pokemon Blue back in the day, and I think that was probably one of the very first games that I sort of technically completed. And when I say completed, I don't mean like I definitely did not get an 151 Pokedex or anything like that, but getting to the Elite Four and then doing the end game bits. And to be fair, I remember this as being the very first game that I ever bought an instruction guide for.
I remember they were all the rage, weren't they?
Yeah, the strategy guide. I had one, an unofficial one, that I bought from W.H. Smith's as a kid.
Don't say the C word.
I like
memorabilia that has a story to it, that has a relationship to it. I think that's why Funko Pops are so popular, because of the nostalgia factor. I think it's a little tangible bit of something very important in someone's history.
I think Funko Pops are hideous.
I love them.
Of course you do.
I've got a full Back to the Future collection.
Of course you have.
I've got nearly the full A-Team collection apart from the van. And I've got an Andre the Giant that's just a little bit bigger than the other ones, which is lovely.
I mean, I get it. And I like stuff like that when they do that. That is cool.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
Which one do you think the heroine did?
From the way you've worded it, I would say the former.
Yes, and this is what young women, you're like teenage girls, are being influenced by, and it's not good.
Ah, oh, I really like your newborn daughter. I'm going to marry her in 18 years.
Oh, yes.
Which is something that happened in the book as well.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Oh, yes. Yes, it does. Anyway, what's the worst book of all time, boys?
Oh, right, well...
And why is it Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.